Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got current events, we're checking in on the royals, and we've got lots of politics as usual. The first article is In Memoriam. I'm sure you have heard by now that Pope Francis, 88, is dead. Considered dogmatic as a young priest, the Argentinian Jesuit emerged during his papacy as an advocate of mercy, humility, and hope. This is by Phil Clay on April 21st. With hope as a key theological virtue, Catholics are not allowed to despair, not of ourselves, nor of our church, nor of the unfolding of history. But for a young American Catholic coming of age at the turn of a millennium, I found that a tall order. A ghastly sex abuse crisis had shattered the church's moral authority. Pope John Paul II's health left him unable to effectively lead, and the U.S. Conference of Bishops seemed so fixated on sexual morality and abortion that the broader revolutionary message of Christianity about the poor and the outcast became less of a voice crying out in the wilderness than a bare whisper in an empty room. The church felt too reactionary, too calcified, too comfortable, crouching defensively rather than leading a charge against the spiritual and moral ills of our time. Pope Benedict XVI, an admittedly brilliant theological mind elevated to the papacy in 2005, didn't offer much change. But then, on the 13th of May 2013, Jorge Mario Bergoglio was elected pope, and from the moment he took the name Francis, the man who gives us this spirit of peace, the poor man, he explained to reporters, for he would like a poor church and for the poor. I still felt startlingly unexpected hope, and I wasn't alone. I never thought I'd have a pope like this in my lifetime, a priest I know told me. It must be divine providence. I can't think of any other explanation. This pope, who died at age 88 this week after prolonged respiratory complications, allowed theological dissent, spoke forcefully about environmentalism, emphasized the brutal effects of globalism, all with a wide, welcoming, and slightly impish smile. There weren't major doctrinal shifts during his pontificate, but there was a long-needed breath of fresh air. I'm not that religious, an elderly relative once told me, but I do believe in Mother Teresa and Pope Francis. Part of the shock of his papacy was how out of character it was from his earlier history. Born in Buenos Aires in 1936, the young Bergoglio studied in technical schools and worked as a janitor, a bouncer, and a lab technician. After becoming a Jesuit priest at 32, he rapidly rose through the clergy, serving as superior of the Jesuit province of Argentina until 1979, only 4 years after taking final vows. 3 years later, a military dictatorship took over the country and violently suppressed the population, kidnapping and killing up to 30,000 alleged leftists, including two Jesuits jailed for their work in poor neighborhoods. One of them, Father Orlando Urio, would accuse Bergoglio of allowing their abduction, albeit with little evidence, and supporters of Francis point to his work helping other dissidents flee the regime. Undoubtedly, though, he was at odds with the Jesuit community he led. Some Jesuits, a famously intellectual and progressive order of priests, chafed under his discipline and his conservative theology. He seemed unaware of any teachings of Vatican II, one of his students later complained. It was all St. Thomas Aquinas and the old church fathers. Bergoglio was also, intriguingly, committed to popular piety. One critic complained that he encouraged students to go out to the chapel at night and touch images. This was something the poor did, the people of the Pueblo, something that the Society of Jesus worldwide just doesn't do. I mean, touching images. What is that? He'd eventually be sent into exile in Córdoba before being named Auxiliary Bishop of Buenos Aires in 1992, where he was still enough of a toxic presence among the Jesuits that he was asked not to reside in Jesuit houses. Upon his ascension to the papacy, the news agency Reuters described him as a theological conservative, and progressive Catholics braced themselves. A Jesuit and family friend told me that the day after his election, the mood among the Jesuits in Rome was like being at a wake. But this was not the same man who'd been a scourge to the progressive priests of 1970s Argentina. As an archbishop and then cardinal, he'd adopted a modest lifestyle, traveling by bus and declining to live in the archbishop's palace. He'd adopted a newfound humility as a spiritual discipline imposed, as one biographer put it, on a personality which has its share of pride and a propensity to dogmatic and domineering behavior. The first pope from the Americas, he became what many referred to as the people's pontiff. He declined to take up residence at the apostolic palace. He carried his own bags. He ritually washed the feet of prisoners. He created a retreat for homeless Romans just steps from the Vatican. He declared a theme for his papacy, misericordia, meaning mercy. At key moments, he would not shy from taking sides, as he did when likening the atrocities of Russian troops in Ukraine to acts of genocide, comparing them to the war crimes committed under Stalin, or when objecting to the cruelty of Israeli airstrikes that killed Palestinian civilians, including children, in Gaza. In February, he roundly criticized the Trump administration's program of mass deportations, noting that Jesus himself had been displaced to Egypt, and warned people of faith not to give in to narratives that discriminate against the cause unnecessary suffering to our migrant and refugee brothers and sisters. One area where he offered less dogmatism and greater flexibility was sexual ethics. "Who am I to judge?" Pope Francis famously answered in response to a reporter's questions about gay priests earlier in his pontificate. Years later, he'd support American Jesuit Father James Martin's outreach to LGBTQ+ Catholics. And his openness to relaxing the church's treatment of divorced and remarried Catholics enraged conservatives who felt he was undermining a critical sacrament. But fights over doctrine underplayed what was perhaps a more pivotal shift, a decentralization of church governance in which the former authoritarian committed himself to ceding authority. And here we saw glimpses of the younger Bergoglio, who wanted his intellectual, often upper-class Jesuit students, to go into the chapel and touch icons, connecting their faith to the people of the pueblo. Francis has pushed for a synodal church. A synod, or a gathering to decide doctrine, demands the faithful first listen attentively to each other's lived experiences before deliberation. And during the 2023 Synod on Synodality, Pope Francis insisted that for the first time in the Church's history, laymen and women participate as full voting members. Archbishop Victor Manuel Fernandez, the head of the Vatican's doctrinal office, said that when he was appointed, "Francis wrote to me that the best way to care for the doctrine of the faith is to grow our understanding of it, because this harmonious growth will preserve Christian doctrine more effectively than any control mechanism, especially if we know how to present a God who loves, who frees, who lifts up, who empowers people." It's this promise I held on to throughout this papacy. The notion that rather than tamp down discussions, the church could be a place for harmonious growth. The fullness of time will reveal whether or not he was successful, but Pope Francis gave me hope. We are moving into the royal section. This title is Why King Charles Won't Be at the Pope's Funeral. Prince William will attend the late pontiff's service on Saturday alongside world leaders in an appearance that will highlight the vital role he plays as heir. This is by Katie Nichol on April 22nd. Prince William will attend Pope Francis's funeral on behalf of King Charles, Kensington Palace confirmed on Tuesday. The Prince of Wales will join world leaders, including President Donald Trump and UK Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer, at the funeral service at St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican on Sunday. King Charles, the last head of state to have an audience with Pope Francis, will not travel to the Vatican in accordance with protocol and precedents which dictates that the sovereign does not attend funerals, Buckingham Palace has confirmed. The attendance of Prince William alongside world leaders highlights the vital role he plays as heir. When Pope John Paul II died in April 2005, Charles and Queen Camilla's wedding was delayed as Charles was required to attend in place of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. King Charles and Queen Camilla visited the late Pope during their tour of Italy 2 weeks ago. The meeting took place at Casa Santa Maria, where Pope Francis died on Easter Monday morning. Charles and Camilla were celebrating their 20th wedding anniversary and received a gift from the Pope during the private meeting. King Charles has spoken of the devastating loss of Pope Francis and said that he and Queen Camilla remember with particular affection their meetings with the Pope over the years and were greatly moved to have been able to visit him earlier in the month. As a mark of respect for the pontiff, flags were flown at half-mast at palaces around the country. Pope Francis died on Monday at age 88 as a result of a stroke. A month earlier, he had been hospitalized for 5 weeks while being treated for double pneumonia. On Easter Sunday, the pontiff had appeared to greet crowds and was driven around St. Peter's Square, where he was cheered on by thousands of well-wishers. Next in the royals, Prince Louis gives a little tooth, a lot of charm, in new 7th birthday portrait. The photo also signals a change to not just a Wales family tradition, but a long-standing royal family one as well. This is by Casey Wickman on April 23rd. The youngest of Kate Middleton and Prince William's 3 children, Prince Louis, marked his 7th birthday Wednesday, and his proud parents shared birthday wishes, a new photo, and a brief video clip of the rambunctious youngest Wales on social media to celebrate along with the world. In the video compilation, we're treated to Louis' seemingly boundless energy and boyish glee he exhibited during the shoot, complete with him grinning into the camera at close range and even a rare snippet of him speaking. "I can jump down from there," he announces, pointing, and then demonstrates by leaping off a log, thrilled. The cinematographer is not tagged, but from Louis' sneaky smiles and close proximity to the shooter, there's a non-zero chance that Kate was behind that phone. Playing Instagram mom. It's not just the clip that's a change to the family's typical birthday offerings. While the Prince and Princess of Wales routinely share new photos of their children to mark birthdays, there are a few subtle ways that Louis' photographic celebration breaks with both Wales family tradition and broader royal family norms. In the portrait, Louis wears an olive green V-neck sweater over a white and blue grid-patterned collared shirt, paired with a pair of blue jeans. It's not the casual connotation of denim that is remarkable here, but that his princely knees are covered by the full-length pants. In the British upper classes, boys typically wear short pants until about the age of 8, stemming from the 16th century concept of breeching, when infants would be dressed first in gowns, regardless of gender, before boys graduated to short pants. The transition to full-length trousers was considered a milestone and mark of maturity, with etiquette expert William Hansen telling Harper's Bazaar in 2018 that a pair of trousers on a young boy is considered quite middle class, quite suburban, and no self-respecting aristo or royal would want to be considered suburban. It's not the very first time we've seen the littlest prince in full trousers. He donned a dark pair with his suit at the 2024 and 2023 Christmas Carol concerts, perhaps a concession to the cold, but any twitch of differing from royal protocol is noteworthy. Maybe he passed some secret test or a very significant arm wrestling match and has been deemed pants-worthy and grown. The other break from tradition is one more personal to the family. The birthday portrait was taken by photographer Josh Schinner, not Kate. The Princess of Wales is a passionate photographer and is usually behind the lens for her children's birthday portraits. She took Louis's first birthday photo, sweater, teeny tiny teeth, second, checkered shirt, rainbow paint-covered hands poised for chaos and mess, third, sweater, special guest star bicycle, fourth, sweater, sand, and sixth, checkered shirt, blink and you'll miss it, missing lower tooth, birthday pictures. Only this year, and Louis's 5th birthday, sweater, wheelbarrow, mom, when the family released sweet shots of Louis and Princess Kate taken by Millie Pilkington, because how is mom supposed to take the photo when she's in the photo, has someone else done the photographic honors? Though Schinner is new to the Louis Birthday Photo Hall of Fame, this isn't the first time he's captured the Wales family's likenesses. He was the photographer behind the family's 2023 holiday card, bearing a black and white group shot. In an Instagram caption, he called that experience without a doubt one of the most relaxed and enjoyable sittings I've ever had. We're moving to other current event news. Virginia Giuffre, who accused Jeffrey Epstein and Prince Andrew of sex abuse, dies at age 41. In separate, since-settled claims, Giuffre accused Epstein of sex trafficking and said Andrew sexually abused her when she was under 18. This is by Eve Beatty on April 26th. Virginia Giuffre, who put a face to the multitudes of women allegedly victimized by convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, died by suicide on Thursday, April 24th, family members confirm. She was 41. Giuffre rose to global prominence in 2019, soon after Epstein was found dead in prison. According to Giuffre, when she was 15 and working at President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, Ghislaine Maxwell approached her as a masseuse for Epstein. Instead, Giuffre alleged, she was sexually abused by Maxwell and Epstein and trafficked to men around the world while under 18, including British royal Prince Andrew. Both men deny Giuffre's allegations, but they also settled civil suits Giuffre brought against them, Epstein paying her $500,000 in 2009, and Andrew reaching a confidential agreement with her just days before the trial in the case was expected to begin. Neither faced criminal charges as a result of Giuffre's accusations. The repercussions of Giuffre's claims against Andrew remain visible today. In an effort to repair his image, Andrew agreed to a 2019 interview with BBC's Newsnight to discuss his relationship with Epstein and Giuffre's allegations of abuse, but the interview backfired so badly that the royal was banished from much of royal life, and the interview itself was adapted into multiple dramatic properties. It is with utterly broken hearts that we announce that Virginia passed away last night at her farm in Western Australia. She lost her life to suicide after being a lifelong victim of sexual abuse and sex trafficking, a statement provided by a representative of Giuffre's family reads. Virginia was a fierce warrior in the fight against sexual abuse and sex trafficking. She was the light that lifted so many survivors. Despite all the adversity she faced in her life, she shone so bright. She was heroic and will always be remembered for her incredible courage and loving spirit. In the end, the toll of abuse is so heavy that it became unbearable for Virginia to handle its weight. We know that she is with the angels. It appears that Giuffre was facing some significant struggles in her final weeks. The BBC reports that she violated a legal order prohibiting her from making contact with her family in February. The following month, her publicist said that Giuffre had sustained serious injuries in a vehicle collision, but declined to provide additional details. A March post by Giuffre to social media suggested she only had a few days to live as a result of the crash, but local authorities could not confirm such a collision. In a statement sent to People magazine, a spokesperson for the Western Australia Police Force says that emergency service responders were called to a residence in Nyrgabi, Australia, on reports of an unresponsive woman. Virginia Giuffre, who had reportedly lived in Nyrgabi for several years, was pronounced dead at the scene, and while major crime detectives are investigating, the case is not considered suspicious. Josh Schiffer, an attorney for one of Epstein's victims, tells The Guardian that Giuffre deserves credit for bringing the convicted sexual assailant to justice. The case wouldn't have existed without her input, her cooperation, her bravery at the beginning, inspiring so many other people to come forward, he said. Her loss will hopefully be a marker and almost an inspiration for people to calling attention to the epidemic that is sex trafficking, that is the international sex industry. This is an issue that still persists. It changes its form all the time, and it exists all around the world. This just happens to be a really prominent example. Our next article is going to springboard us into the politics section. The People's Pope: Build Bridges, Not Walls. Pope Francis's funeral sermon offered thinly veiled reminder to President Donald Trump. The U.S. president and the pontiff frequently exchanged criticisms over compassion for migrants, a group Trump has repeatedly sought to deport. This is by Katie Hirschenroeder on April 26th. One of Pope Francis's dying wishes, as proclaimed by Cardinal Giovanni Battista Re at his funeral on Saturday in Rome, where hundreds of thousands of mourners came to honor the people's pope, was that leaders of the world build bridges and not walls. President Donald Trump, who launched his political career in part on the phrase, "build the wall," sat in the front row. Pope Francis incessantly raised his hand, imploring peace and calling for reason and honest negotiation to find possible solutions, Cardinal Re said as he delivered the homily. "Build bridges, not walls," was an exhortation he repeated many times. Aboard Air Force One on his way to Italy on Friday, Trump told reporters that he was attending the funeral out of respect for Francis, adding, "I won the Catholic vote." And since arriving in Italy, Trump has been documenting his trip on Truth Social, sharing videos of him walking toward his seat at the funeral and standing in front of the late Pope's simple Cyprus coffin. The president, alongside his wife Melania Trump, was one of several world leaders who were seated on the stairs of St. Peter's Basilica for what the New York Times reports was a solemn and majestic funeral. Former President Joe Biden and former First Lady Jill Biden, Britain's Prince William, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, French President Emmanuel Macron, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, along with other global heads, were also in attendance. Prior to Saturday morning service, President Trump sat down with Zelensky at the Vatican, the pair's first meeting since their televised clash in the Oval Office in February. White House spokesman Stephen Chung called it a very productive discussion, but gave no details. In a separate social media post, Zelensky said they had a good meeting. "We discussed a lot one-on-one, hoping for results on everything we covered, protecting lives of our people, full and unconditional ceasefire, reliable and lasting peace that will prevent another war from breaking out. Very symbolic meeting that has potential to become historic if we achieve joint results, the Ukrainian president wrote, thanking and tagging Trump. The president and Pope Francis have clashed several times since Trump's first bid for the White House nearly a decade ago. In 2016, the Pope criticized Trump's proposal to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, telling reporters at the time that a person who only thinks about building walls wherever they may be and not building bridges is not Christian. Trump quickly fired back, saying, "For a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful." If and when the Vatican is attacked by ISIS, which, as everyone knows, is ISIS's ultimate trophy, I can promise you that the Pope would have only wished and prayed that Donald Trump would have been president, he said in a statement. Then, when the pair met during a 2017 trip to the Vatican, the new president claimed they had a fantastic meeting. This interaction gave rise to the viral photo of Trump and Francis standing next to each other with very different expressions. Trump is smiling widely and Pope Francis is not. Fast forward to Trump's second presidency, and the Pope again made a rare rebuke of the United States' leadership. In a public letter from February to Catholic bishops in the United States, Francis described the program of mass deportation as a major crisis. "Deporting migrants who often come from difficult situations," Francis wrote, "violates the dignity of many men and women and of entire families," adding that he had followed closely the major crisis that is taking place in the United States with the initiation of a program of mass deportations, and believes that any policy built on force begins badly and will end badly. Cardinal Re's homily on Saturday highlighted the Pope's insistence on traveling to places where people were experiencing displacement and insecurity about where they could live and how they would feed their families. His gestures and exhortations in favor of refugees and displaced persons are countless, Re said. He established direct contact with individuals and peoples, eager to be close to everyone, with a marked attention to those in difficulty, giving himself without measure, especially to the marginalized, the least among us. He was a pope among the people. Next up in politics, the White House Correspondents' Dinner will toast the press as Trump thoroughly roasts it. Even in these precarious times, journalists are set to don tuxes and gowns at the Washington Hilton, sans Trump, and swarm sundry parties and brunches. Perhaps gathering together is what's needed in this second term because, as one reporter says, the solidarity of the press corps is going to be really tested. This is by Natalie Korak on April 24th. In an emotional Tuesday afternoon meeting, outgoing 60 Minutes executive producer Bill Owens reportedly expressed concerns to staff that the venerable news program was losing its independence, a scenario playing out as CBS News parent Paramount is reportedly in talks to settle a lawsuit of dubious merit brought by President Donald Trump. "The company," Owens told his team, according to The Times, "is done with me." In 4 days, CBS News staffers will gather for a more festive occasion, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. The network is hosting a Saturday pre-party with Politico, one of a flurry of fetes and boozy brunches sponsored by news outlets and talent agencies that will take place at Washington hotels and hotspots, ambassadors' residences, and backyard gardens. But alongside this year's celebration of the First Amendment are reminders of just how much press freedom is being challenged in a second Trump term, involving everything from White House access restrictions to free speech threats. "We're in for a wild ride in terms of the games they're going to play," one political reporter told me, referring to the administration. "The guardrails are gone in this second term," the reporter added, "and as a result, the solidarity of the press corps is going to be really tested." Trump is skipping Saturday's dinner at the Washington Hilton, just as he did during his first term. The WHCA weathered such snubs in the past, but this time around, the organization is grappling with an administration that's already taken away one of the journalist-led group's primary functions and could nab a second. In February, the White House indicated it would move to handpick the media outlets participating in the Daily Press Pool, a group of journalists who cover the president's words and actions in smaller settings for the news media, including when the president travels out of Washington. Jackie Heinrich, Fox News reporter and a member of the WHCA board, told Vanity Fair that she was specifically concerned about the administration taking control of the press pool, saying, "I'm not sure the administration was thinking about the long run when they made the decision." "You don't want access to the leader of the free world to be dependent on favorable coverage," Heinrich added. "That's the whole reason why the WHCA self-organized, beginning back in the early 1900s. It's just not what America stands for." A major source of tension is a continued court battle playing out between the Associated Press and the White House, which banned the outlet from the press pool in February after the AP's refusal to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America in its coverage. The AP sued the administration in response, arguing that the ban raised questions about press freedom. On April 8th, a federal judge ruled in favor of the Newswire, finding the ban in violation of the First Amendment and ordering the White House to reinstate access. Just days later, the White House said that it was eliminating the rotating press pool spot for three major newswires, which includes the AP, along with Reuters and Bloomberg News. The AP filed a motion asking the court to enforce the injunction requiring the administration to allow the AP back into the pool rotation, which was denied by a federal judge in Washington. Judge Trevor N. McFadden categorized the new policy as facially neutral, adding that he would need time to determine whether it resulted in viewpoint discrimination. This past Saturday, the AP had finally made its way back into the official press pool. However, Trump had no public events on his schedule. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently in the middle of an article from the politics section about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. CNN's Caitlin Collins called the White House's fight with the AP obviously retaliatory in nature and a slippery slope for the administration to start heading down. The network's chief White House correspondent, who previously served as the WHCA president, is all for expanding the press pool. But when you start taking people away or removing people or banning them, that is where it's dangerous territory. That's kind of the moment we're at now, she tells me. Meanwhile, in the White House briefing room, officials have made room for a new cohort of more partisan attendees, like right-wing podcasters, who often ask less adversarial questions than traditional journalists. As the New York Times recently put it, still, as Paul Farhi points out, it's the more mainstream news outlets who are churning out the biggest Trump 2.0 scoops. The White House is reportedly considering shaking up the seating arrangements in the briefing room, which had also long been handled by the WHCA. And on the legal front, both ABC News and Meta settled lawsuits with Trump after his victory in November, what some legal experts see as a dangerous precedent for media and tech companies. Then there's Trump's $10 billion suit against CBS. He's accused the network of illegal behavior over a 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris. CNN's Jake Tapper reported that one 60 Minutes source described the suit to him as baseless and that Owens fought for the broadcast and for independent journalism, and that cost him his job. A CBS News spokesperson declined to comment. The festivities in Washington kick off on Thursday with a slew of parties, including a semaphore gala held in a courtyard of the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the Washington Women in Journalism Awards, an Axios event in partnership with OpenAI, and Oliver Darcy's Status newsletter event in defense of the First Amendment. Both Punchbowl News and Axios will hold daytime events Friday in conversation with political newsmakers, while there are evening parties sponsored by Vanity Fair parent Condé Nast and CAA, WME, UTA, and the Brunswick Group and Daily Mail. Tommy Haddad hosts her traditional Saturday brunch, Tammy Haddad, which is followed by pre-dinner receptions held at the Hilton. A hot late-night ticket is the NBC Universal After Party, which should rage until the early morning hours, giving attendees a few hours before they flock to Sunday brunches held by CNN and All Britain Journalism Institute. WHCA President Eugene Daniels described this as a consequential moment for journalism in a statement, citing the need to focus not on the politics of division, but on celebrating the work of WHCA colleagues and political media at large. Heinrich echoed this statement and continued value of the dinner in our recent interview, telling me that the event is a celebration of the work that we do, the scholarships that we're awarding, and the importance of journalism, which is something that you celebrate, no matter if the president is attending or not. As for the dinner itself, it will be a more stoic affair than in years past, which have featured headlining entertainment, most recently SNL's Colin Jost in 2024. Comedian Amber Ruffin was scheduled to take the Hilton stage, but the WHCA scrapped her appearance in late March, nearly 2 months after it was announced. One New York-based communications operative I spoke to, who would typically make the Amtrak pilgrimage from Manhattan to D.C. for the party circuit, said they weren't sure if it was even worth a trip this year, since the mood might be depressing. They worry that the typical weekend events of drinking and partying will normalize a moment that shouldn't be normalized. In the end, however, they caved. Next up, Trump's approval rating is steadily tanking, even worse than 100-day marks for Biden, Obama, or Bush. You could probably guess how he feels about the polling, though of course he says the numbers are fake. This is by Issy Lepowski on April 24th. If Donald Trump is making America great again, then someone really should inform America, because according to a slew of unflattering polling this week, most Americans don't appear convinced. A record 53% of Americans now say their economic situation is getting worse, according to a Gallup poll conducted in early April, the first time a majority of Americans have felt that way since 2001. Meanwhile, just 37% of U.S. adults approve of Trump's handling of the economy, the worst Trump has ever performed on that front, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll. And perhaps most bruising for Trump himself, his favorite news network, Fox, is out with a new poll showing that, as he approaches his 100-day mark, Trump's approval rating is now just 44%, lower than Joe Biden, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush were at this point in their own presidencies. Trump responded to this feedback from the American people with characteristic restraint and contrition. Just kidding. He lashed out on Truth Social, lobbying for media magnate Rupert Murdoch to fire his hating fake pollster at Fox. While he's at it, he should start making changes at the China-loving Wall Street Journal. It sucks, Trump wrote. The Fox poll, conducted April 18th to 21st, reveals that the only issue on which the majority of registered voters, 55%, approve of Trump's performance is on border security. On every other issue, he's underwater. Voters' outlook on Trump is particularly bleak when it comes to economic issues, where his approval ratings for his handling of inflation, tariffs, taxes, and the economy writ large hover between 33% and 38%. Only 28% of registered voters feel like the economy is getting better, slightly lower than around this time last year. Overall, more than half, 51% of registered voters in the Fox poll say Trump's policies are hurting the country, while just 40% say they're helping it. Even on immigration, which is one of the administration's most favorable issues, just 47% approve of Trump's performance, compared to 48% who disapprove. In January, according to Gallup, 68% of respondents thought the stock market would go up over the next 6 months. Now, 58% think it will decline. Trump promised to usher in a golden age of prosperity. It's landing more like lead. Our next headline, RFK Jr.'s Month of Magical Thinking. The Department of Health and Human Services secretary is trying to remake the country into the bizarro world he seems to think it is. This is by Issy Lepowski on April 25th. If you had to hand it to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for one thing, and you certainly do not, at least the guy's consistent. Over the last month, the Department of Health and Human Services secretary, best known for his vaccine conspiracies and entirely too frequent dalliances in animal mutilation, has been pumping out a steady stream of plans to make America healthy again that are based, well, not entirely in reality. On Tuesday, Kennedy claimed to have an understanding with major food manufacturers to phase out food dyes by 2026, saying that 4 years from now, we're going to have the most of these products off the market. But that splashy announcement was mostly based on what would be voluntary commitments that many of the biggest players in the food industry have not yet agreed to, according to Axios. A voluntary phase-out is also hardly ironclad. History tells us that relying on voluntary food industry compliance has all too often proven to be a fool's errand, Peter Lurie, a former Food and Drug Administration official, told the New York Times. Next came Kennedy's whopper during an interview on Fox News, where he claimed that when his uncle John F. Kennedy was president, the rate of chronic disease in America was just 3%, compared to 60% today. In reality, according to fact-checkers at the Washington Post who awarded that claim for Pinocchio's, that number was 44.5%. In fact, the rate was likely higher since people were less likely to be diagnosed with things like hypertension at the time. Then, of course, there's Kennedy's disturbing and easily dispelled myth-making about autism. Kennedy has continued to cast autism as an epidemic that's characterized by profound impairments in what can only be described as willful ignorance of the vast spectrum of ways that autism presents itself. Kennedy's statements and apparent plans to use private data to track autistic people have prompted an outcry from autistic people and scientists alike. On Friday, a group of some 160 scientists announced the formation of a group called the Coalition of Autism Scientists in direct response to Kennedy's falsehoods. The Coalition of Autism Scientists came together to demand respect for autism research. Helen Tager-Flusberg, director of the Center for Autism Research at Boston University and the leader of the group, wrote in a statement, "Instead of focusing on questions that have been asked and answered, limited and valuable research dollars must focus on what we don't yet know about autism so that we can meet the urgent needs of autism individuals and their families. The question, of course, is what Kennedy is up to with all of this misdirection. On one hand, there's the possibility that he is a true believer in the conspiracies he peddles. On the other, there's the far likelier scenario that he knows it's precisely where his power lies." Next up, so Kash Patel and the FBI are locking up judges now. The arrest of a Wisconsin judge for allegedly impeding ICE enforcement in her courtroom marks a chilling new front in Trump's war on the courts. This is by Issy Lepowski on April 25th. In a startling escalation of the Trump administration's assault on the judicial system, a county judge in Wisconsin was arrested on charges of obstructing immigration enforcement. The news of Judge Hannah Dugan's arrest came Friday via a post on X from FBI Director Kash Patel, who said the FBI believes Dugan intentionally misdirected federal agents who were attempting to arrest a man named Eduardo Flores Ruiz, who was appearing in Dugan's courtroom. Ruiz was arrested that day by Immigration and Customs Enforcement after ICE agents chased down the perp on foot, Patel wrote. According to the New York Times, charging documents allege that Dugan confronted federal agents when they attempted to arrest Ruiz at her courthouse and subsequently led him out of the courtroom through a jury door. Dugan has since been charged with two felonies, obstructing and concealing an individual, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In a hearing Friday, Dugan's lawyer said, "Judge Dugan wholeheartedly regrets and protests her arrest. It was not made in the interest of public safety." The Trump administration was already on a collision course with the courts amid its draconian crackdown on both undocumented and legal immigrants over the last 2 months. But even in the face of flouted court orders, procedural stonewalling, and calls for judges to be impeached over unfavorable rulings, the arrest of a sitting judge for allegedly impeding ICE's operations is a new, though not entirely unprecedented, low. According to the Times, in President Trump's first term, a Massachusetts judge was also arrested on similar charges, which were later dropped. Dugan's arrest also speaks to the extent to which the Trump administration is trying to rope all of America's institutions and their officials into his vast immigration dragnet. In one of his first moves in office, Trump empowered ICE to target people in schools, churches, and courthouses for deportation. But officials have warned that arresting people appearing in court for other offenses is particularly fraught, risking public safety by minimizing the chances that people will show up to court. "We cannot have a functional legal system if people are justifiably afraid to show up for legal proceedings, especially when ICE agents have already repeatedly grabbed people off the street in retaliation for speech and free association without even obtaining the proper warrants," Wisconsin State Representative Ryan Clancy wrote in a statement Friday. While the facts in this case are still unfolding, it's clear that the actions like Judge Dugan's are what is required for democracy to survive the Trump regime. Next headline, head case. The new Trump 2028 hat isn't just ugly, it's a headgear harbinger. A little bit of background on the newest MAGA swag to hit the Trump store, topping off a constitutional threat. This is by Casey Wickman on April 25th. What's in a baseball hat? These days, if it's red, a whole lot of menace, subtext, and dark hidden history are lurking behind the seams. Donald Trump's innovatively named web shop, Trump Store, on Thursday debuted a variation on the red ball cap he's made ubiquitous over the past, 9 years. Instead of "Make America Great Again," the white text on this next-gen dorky-ass puffy dad hat reads, "Trump 2028," in a text lockup big enough to make any graphic designer take a moment to collect themselves, lest they give in to the aesthetic despair threatening to overtake them. For the low price of $50, plus shipping, you can plaster your disregard for the U.S. Constitution, democracy, individual freedoms, and general human decency across your forehead. What a bargain! The Trumpian attention to detail is apparent in the product listing. Flag embroidery on side is a listed feature, typo and all. It says embroidery, not embroidery. Of course, anyone on the market for this latest gritty reboot of fascist hats probably already has one or more flavors of MAGA hat to their name. But hey, I've heard that variety is the spice of life. The design is a reference to Trump's recent teases of a 2028 run and a constitutional overhaul to allow him to do so, and a prop for the MAGAites to goad those who've been hoping that we'll be rewarded for surviving these 4 years with the knowledge that we won't ever have to put up with the guy making decisions that impact us again. You'd also think that being a convicted felon would have the same result, so fool me twice and all that. The listing has touch of plausible deniability by featuring a photo of Eric Trump serving as a noggin model. He's a Trump too. This ding-dong could, but should not, run. but instantly dashes it with the copywriting that invites wearers to rewrite the rules with the hat. Ugh. Of course, this isn't the first notable tweak on the MAGA hat design, like Elon Musk's infamous dark MAGA black-on-black topper, a version of which, with less Hot Topic-y font, is available in Trump's store for $55. A recent revelation embroiders a new layer of cringe to the look. The Wall Street Journal revealed that it was gifted to Musk by none other than baby mama Ashley St. Clair. Remember her? The one with whom he at one point offered $15 million plus a $100,000 monthly stipend in exchange for keeping the baby he fathered with her, Romulus, his 13th born publicly known kid, a secret. She rejected the offer. The symbolism of Musk's very public fashion statements, or origins in a personal life so lurid he needs to offer hush money to keep her quiet, can't be overlooked. The first MAGA hat worn by Trump wasn't red, either. He donned a white version in July 2015 at a visit to the border in Laredo, Texas, shortly after announcing his candidacy. Former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski told CNN that the hats had been hanging around for a bit, but the debut was a matter of practicality. Just for the sweat factor and other things, he chose to wear the hat. The campaign slogan it bore wasn't an original one, though it will now be forever tied to Trump. Before him, the phrase was used by George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, and most recently, Bill Clinton. Trump once even tried to claim that the latter endorsed him using snippets of archival footage on social media. The great again Trump yearns for its specific span of American history, from 1870 to 1913, a tariff-heavy time in which Stanford University's Richard White told the AP, nobody, except for the very rich, wanted to live in the Gilded Age economy. Trump would also likely be into voter norms of the period. Women weren't granted the right to vote until 1920, and despite the 15th Amendment's ratification in 1870, black men weren't able to fully exercise their constitutional right to vote until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. A golden age indeed. Hats have long been a signifier of affinity, whether it's a ball cap showing that you're on the same sports team or a fan of one, or any number of the pink knitted pussy hats donned by protesters during Trump's first term, the titular headgear of the Red Hat Society's free-spirited sisterhood, the coveted camouflage Harris Waltz hat, and beyond. Often, what's on your head is an easy way to show what's in your head. There's still room for Trump faithful, who just don't have a face for hats. The store also offers a red Trump 2028 shirt. Another more than apt metaphor, if you're in the market for one. Consider that college athletes can have red shirt status, a loophole that allows student athletes to stretch their eligibility by spending a year on the team, but participating in an extremely limited capacity. This is akin to the argument Trump supporters have offered by pointing out that the Constitution doesn't say anything about serving more than two non-consecutive terms. And then there's the pop culture trope of red shirts, which originated with Star Trek and spread. The term refers to characters who are doomed to die en masse at the hands of Big Bad, stemming from red uniform shirts' eventual casualties, often wore on board the Starship Enterprise. Make that death ideological and you've got yourself a Trump supporter ball game. And then there's the image of a Trump 2032 hat Musk recently shared on social media, captioning it, "Think ahead." Alternate idea. Let's not. It's time to put a cap on this nonsense. Yes, even the beer koozie. There are other ways to insulate a beverage. Our next headline, the optics battle of Luigi Mangione's federal arraignment. The 26-year-old accused of killing a healthcare CEO cut a silent but potent figure in a Manhattan courtroom on Friday. This is by Dan Adler on April 25th. At almost exactly 1 p.m. on Friday, Luigi Mangione walked into a Manhattan federal courtroom through the back door. In his beige prison garb, flanked by U.S. Marshals, he looked expressionless. But as he sat and chatted with his attorney, Mark Agnifilo, he broke into a couple of smiles. For the duration of the 35-minute hearing following Mangione's federal indictment on charges of stalking and murdering healthcare CEO Brian Thompson, the defendant was mostly an observer. At 1:06 p.m., he had a chance to say seven words. "I have," in response to whether he had seen the indictment. "Yes," to confirm he'd had enough time to review it. "I waive," to forego his right to have the indictment read in court, and then Mangione gave his plea of not guilty. If the proceeding was mild, the moral and political weight surrounding it had been staggering. Thompson's killing took place after Donald Trump was reelected, but about a month and a half before he took office again. The case, an instant global news phenomenon, turned Mangione into a cult hero in some corners, a telegenic face with a widely resonant message. For the Trump administration, it has been an opportunity to flex the punitive muscle that has quickly become the defining hallmark of the president's second term. On Thursday, the day before Mangione was arraigned, federal prosecutors filed their formal notice of intent to seek the death penalty. Mangione elected to murder Thompson under these circumstances to amplify an ideological message, they wrote, maximize the visibility and impact of the victim's murder, and to provoke broad-based resistance to the victim's industry. In late March, after vandalism meant to protest Elon Musk had been reported at several Tesla dealerships, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi posted a disorienting video of herself speaking with a chilling flatness. "If you take part in the wave of domestic terrorism against Tesla properties," she said, "we will find you, arrest you, and put you behind bars." This, in large part, has constituted the Department of Justice's public rhetoric under Trump, with the administration's gleeful use of social media to roll out its most aggressive measures. Mangione's lawyers have argued that Bondi's motivation in announcing her intent to seek the death penalty was to generate press, noting that she discussed the decision in a Fox News interview and publicly released her order so she would have content for her newly launched Instagram account. Outside the courthouse, one man echoed Bondi's fervor. Scott Lobido, a Staten Island-born artist who has achieved a minor degree of tabloid notoriety for his pro-Trump creations, displayed a crude work titled Deep Fried Luigi, featuring a skeleton strapped to an electric chair and wearing the green hat of the video game character Luigi, a common signifier for Mangione. "Fuck Luigi and his jag-off followers," read a sign Lobido held above his head. A more sizable crowd came out in support of Mangione, including about 15 protesters with a vivid array of signs. "Counterproductive but not criminal," and "No more death by deductible" were among the hoisted messages. A business card I found on the ground gave URL for Pro Mangione fan site. It also had a message, "Expose the plot of the most brutal betrayal and sabotage of Luigi Mangione's right to a fair trial and to the voice of We the People, plotted by criminal activist Kathy Hochul and vicious Karen Friedman Agnifilo." Mark Agnifilo's wife, Karen Friedman Agnifilo, is also an attorney for Mangione. Prosecutors say they've been in touch with Thompson's family about developments in this case. Mangione is due back in state court on June 22nd. He's been charged in a parallel case in New York and pleaded not guilty. His next federal hearing will take place on December 5th, at which point U.S. District Judge Margaret Garnett will seek to set a trial date. Garnett instructed prosecutors to communicate with Bondi and her subordinates about public commentary on the case in order to ensure that Mangione receives a fair trial. As reporters and observers walked out of the courtroom, Mark Agnifilo had his arm on Mangione's shoulder. He smiled a couple of times and appeared to be listening intently. In a little lighter news, Ivanka Trump's vacation beach reads include titles beloved by anti-Trumpers, including Oprah. In a post-spring break photo dump that included snaps of the first daughter jumping in exultation, she revealed to the three New York Times bestsellers she read Until the Sun Dipped Low. This is by Casey Wickman on April 23rd. The words spring break, tend to conjure images of wild college trips, wet t-shirt contests, and phosphorescent drinks in sweating plastic cups. For parents of younger children, however, the week off is more often an opportunity to sit down, keep half an eye on the kids to make sure they don't accidentally destroy themselves, and maybe read an Oprah's book club selection or two. Judging by Ivanka Trump's Instagram photo dump on Tuesday, the latter was the vibe of her recent family vacation with husband Jared Kushner and kids Arabella, 14, Joseph, 11, and Theodore, 9, to Costa Rica. Of the 18 photos and videos included in her carousel, just one slide does not feature the beach and or a horse, a picture of her reading list. And boy, is it interesting to read into her pics. In the post's caption, in which she gushes about how grateful she is for the trip, the word doesn't begin to cover it, she insists. Trump describes logging off and tuning in, grounding in nature's rhythm, feeling the sacred in the silence, in the laughter of my children, in the breath of the trees. Ivanka also, in her own words, read until the sun dipped low. Three favorites are arrayed on a bedspread: Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin, The Women by Kristen Hanna, and The Tell by Amy Griffin. The books have a few things in common. They're all written by female authors and feature main characters that could fall under the strong female lead umbrella. They're all distinguished members of the New York Times bestseller club. The two fictional entries, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, and The Women, both had their film rights snapped up in a big deal movie contract before the books even hit the shelves. Although none of the three authors have openly criticized Ivanka's dear old dad, Donald Trump, they carry thematic messages that he might not love so much. And the books she read have been praised by other authors and public figures who have spoken publicly against her father. Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which was published in 2022, follows two friends and eventual creative collaborators through decades, from childhood to middle age to co-creating a hit video game along the way and facing various slings and arrows, together and apart. A major theme of the novel is the push-pull between money and art, a salient topic in a time when artists face personal and financial peril under an unsmiling government. The book was a critical and commercial success and made the New York Times list of the 100 most notable books of the 21st century. Among its fans are author John Green, Bill Gates, and DNC speaker Oprah Winfrey, who included the book on her list of the best books of 2022. The next book, The Women by Kristen Hanna, is a historical fiction account of a young woman working as a military nurse during the Vietnam War. It was also an instant number one New York Times bestseller. It explores themes of mental health and trauma, not things Trump is a huge believer in, besides his many gaffes around the military veterans. Remember when he said that recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor are in bad shape or dead? Or his assertion that those who seek help for mental health or suffer from PTSD aren't strong? Bill Gates called Hanna's book a beautifully written tribute to a group of veterans who deserve more appreciation for the incredible sacrifices they made. And New York Times journalist dubbed the book historical fiction at its very best. And then there's the recent release, The Tell, a memoir from Griffin. It's also a bestseller and got the full Oprah's Book Club treatment, sticker on the cover, and all. In the book, Griffin details how she uncovered childhood and sexual trauma with the help of psychedelic drugs. Chanel Miller, author of Know My Name, her own account of the trauma being sexually assaulted by Brock Turner, praised the book as transformative and illuminating. Miller invoked Trump, accused several times over of sexual assault, which he denied in her own memoir, writing, "We live in a time where it's become difficult to distinguish between the president's words and that of a 19-year-old assailant. Society gives women the near impossible task of separating harmlessness from danger, the foresight of knowing what some men are capable of." So, Ivanka, tell us, your imaginary book club, what did you take from these books that your dad would almost certainly abhor? This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.